Hello, I'm Paul Soper, and this is the latest in my series of podcasts for the financially curious. Accountants, tax experts, and taxpayers all. You can read the text of this podcast at my website, www.taxationpodcasts.com. I've recently set up a separate blog at taxationpodcastmusings.wordpress.com, which is intended to record some slightly lighter-hearted points there. And I recently added one concerning Olympic torches and their taxability. But on reflection, this raises one of those perennial subjects in taxation: whether an activity is or is not a trade. First, let's remind ourselves about the torch story. 8,000 people are taking part in the Olympic Torch Flame Relay. Some of them are celebrities, some of them are connected with Olympic sponsors, but many ordinary people have been chosen through schemes like that established by Lloyds Bank. After they're part of the relay, the person selected can keep the torch and tracksuit on making a payment of roughly £200, supposedly about half, so we're told, of the actual cost of the torches themselves. Now, some will keep the torch as a souvenir, but many have already found their way onto the online auction sites. Revenue and Customs decided to get in on the act by issuing a press release, pointing out that the torch is a chattel, and the significance of this being that if it's sold for more than £6,000, a capital gains tax liability might arise. And they also pointed out that online traders and others might have an income tax liability, even if sold for less than the chattel exemption, if they were trading. Now, an argument which the revenue don't explore is that if the torch could be said to be machinery, then it would be deemed to be a wasting asset, and so it would be absolutely exempt unless it was used in a business, regardless of what it was sold for. Now, the torch does convert gas into a flame, thereby providing illumination, probably very little, but that might satisfy at least some definitions of what a machine is. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be much chance, though, of a capital gains tax liability arising, because the market price on eBay seems to be about £3,000 per torch, although there are some vendors who are holding out for more. But a number of people have raised a question. Is it possible that a person who buys their own torch because they immediately plan to sell it on is trading, and so would be chargeable to income tax on the whole of the profit made? Trading as a concept in tax law includes not only the obvious act of regularly buying and selling goods, but also some one-off transactions, which are called an adventure in the nature of trade. Lawyers look at what are called the badges of trade in trying to decide whether such a liability is likely to exist. These are concepts derived from many taxation cases that have been considered in the past. And one problem is that they often refer to circumstances that arose many years ago. One case that is often advanced by Revenue and Customs in arguing that an adventure in the nature of trade has taken place is the so-called Rutledge case. Now, this, heard by the courts in the 1930s, concerned a man who supposedly bought and then resold 1 million toilet rolls. And the court, concluding that this was an adventure in the nature of trade, even though it was a one-off transaction, because the subject matter of it was such that a purchase and resale of household goods, unless they were surplus to personal requirements, could only be explained as being an adventure in the nature of trade. Now, there is a suggestion that the toilet rolls never existed, that they were a convenient fiction to conceal the real and illegal nature of the goods that were being traded in. In the 1960s, a royal commission looked at the nature of trading. And in fact, they gathered together decisions in various legal cases and summarised them semi-officially as being badges of trade. These have often been referred to. But of course, circumstances change, and the treatment of these has to alter over the years. One particular problem is applying them to new types of transactions. For example, property development. In the United Kingdom, before the Second World War, property development was normally a process of expansion as cities grew. Developers bought farming land and constructed suburban housing estates. Usually, this was clearly trading. With the advent of the Second World War, large parts of our inner cities were destroyed and needed post-war rebuilding. But when this process had been largely completed, developers didn't go back to expanding the suburbs, because changes in planning law and the Green Belt movement actually ruled that out. Instead, they looked to acquire city centre sites, often assembling a larger site from many smaller ones, and redeveloping, often changing the use of the land significantly from residential use to commercial use, and making very substantial fortunes in the process. One developer, called Harry Hyams, he was the chap who developed the Centrepoint Tower in central London, specialised in building property which he then kept empty, on the grounds that that building value was a function of rental yield, and future rental values would rise substantially. This would then make the building worth rather more empty than it would be if it was immediately let. So he kept the building empty for many, many years. Was this trading? In the 1970s and 80s, the courts considered this problem in a number of cases, including two rather interesting ones, Taylor and Good and Marson and Morton. Taylor and Good, in 1974, concerned a greengrocer who purchased a large landed estate at an auction back in 1959, before post-war building controls had been removed. He'd grown up in the house, his parents were servants on the estate, and he then, claiming that he wanted to occupy the property as his residence, applied for and obtained planning permission to convert the estate into 93 individual dwelling units. Now, before carrying out the development, he sold the property on to an established property developer for a very substantial sum, because in the meantime, the restrictions on post-war building had been lifted. The courts applied the traditional badges of trade and concluded that his motive had been to live in the property until he received an offer that he really couldn't refuse. If he formed an intention to trade, it was when that offer was received, and that would cause the special rule on appropriation to be invoked. If you acquire an asset for a non-trading purpose and then decide to bring it into a trade, it is appropriated at its current market value, not the original cost. This would be a deemed disposal for capital gains tax purposes, and of course it meant that probably the greatest part of the increase in value would have been taxed as a gain. Now the courts were looking really at a type of transaction that was quite new, and the existing badges of trade couldn't really be made to fit, except with a struggle. But Marson and Morton, in 1986, concerned four brothers who bought a plot of land on the advice of a property developer. They were told it would be a good thing, and they sold it on 3 months later. After repaying the overdraft that they used to finance the acquisition, they found that they doubled their money in this very short period of time. One of them actually went so far to admit that they had purchased the land as a speculation, although another claimed that they intended to keep it as an investment, even though it would not produce any income and could only generate a profit by sale, and it was financed by short-term borrowing. The court, in this case, decided to restate the traditional badges of trade to make them relevant to property transactions of this type, and they added certain other factors, such as the method of financing and previous expertise in a particular type of transaction. Now, notwithstanding this, the Commission has found as a fact that the land was purchased as an investment, and the High Court found that they couldn't disturb this finding. The speculation, therefore, was not an adventure in the way of trade. A runner in the torch relay, particularly if they are a sponsored one, does not acquire the torch as an adventure in the nature of trade. If they formed an opinion that they did want to sell it subsequently, even this would probably not be an adventure in the nature of trade. And of course, even if it were, then, like Taylor and Good, the torch would be appropriated at current market value, and presumably that would be close to what it was eventually sold for. Of course, if a trader purchased a torch from a participant and then sold it on, that would almost certainly be a trading transaction. But they would presumably pay a lot more than the £215 that it cost the runner to acquire the torch. Or so one would hope. But you know, this question, whether a trade is being carried on or not, can be relevant in other areas. Consider a case earlier this year concerning a tax avoidance scheme based upon film exploitation. The case of Eclipse Film Partners LLP No. 35 and Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. The idea behind the scheme was that a syndicate of investors would borrow a substantial sum of money by way of loan, and these funds were to be used to acquire, for a very short period, the rights to distribute two films made by the Disney Corporation. Those rights would then be sold back again, although if the films were very, very successful, further profits might accrue. The two films were called Enchanted and Underdog. On 3rd April 2007, the rights to the films were acquired for sums close to £790 million and then leased back again to Disney for £784 million, a cost, obviously, of some £6 million. The members had injected £50 million into the scheme, but the bulk of the finance was provided by those diamond bankers, Barclays, on loan terms, which would be repaid out of the proceeds received. No member would be liable to pay any part of the loan back. Now, as part of the agreement, a substantial sum of interest was prepaid, with the intention that the film partnership members should obtain interest relief to offset against their income for the tax year 2006-07. In effect, the £50 million they injected was to be turned into a tax deduction worth substantially more. But this could only work if the partnership was trading in the year in question, the year in which the interest was paid in advance. The tribunal held that this was not an adventure in the nature of trade. It was merely a speculative investment, and as a result, the participants would not benefit from the interest relief that they thought that they could claim. It was a business, but it was a non-trade business. So, whether a trade is being carried on can be seen to be a quite complex issue. We don't have time to examine each of the many badges of trade individually. But sometimes whether a trade is being carried on can lead to arguments not dissimilar to those of the Middle Ages, when theologians would discuss the number of angels that could dance upon the head of a pin. So, a taxpayer might buy an asset, whether it's an Olympic torch, plot of land, a million toilet rolls, or a commercial film, and imagine on sale that they might have made a capital gain, in which case their capital gains tax liability would be a maximum of 28%. It would obviously be a very nasty shock if Revenue and Customs successfully contended that it was an adventure in the nature of trade, and they find they have an income tax and national insurance liability at a rate which could be 52% or even higher. This podcast was presented, written and produced by Paul Soper, who asserts copyright therein. The full text of the podcast can be read at my site, taxationpodcasts.com. For further details of podcast production, particularly if you'd like me to create them for you, contact me at paulsoper, all one word, at mac.com. And so, until next month...